You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we'll talk to a disability rights advocate about how to support a child with disabilities as the school year starts back up. Now, what do people in Wisconsin think about President Trump and his potential campaign opponents? Governor Evers, how about gun control? Marquette Law School has results out today from its first statewide poll since this spring. Charles Franklin is director of the Marquette Law School Survey, also professor of law and public policy at Marquette Law School. Charles, welcome back to Central Time.
Good to be here.
All right, new results out today. Let's start national. What do we see when we look at President Trump and his potential Democratic challengers?
Sure. We asked about the four Democrats who are leading in national polling. Joe Biden has a significant lead, 51-42 over President Trump, with 6% saying either neither or they don't know. When we move to Bernie Sanders, who won the state in the Democratic primary in 2016, he has a small advantage, 48-44 over Trump, with 7% not choosing either. When we get to Warren and Harris, though, we have a tie. Warren at 45, Trump at 45, with 10% undecided. And with Harris, it's 44-44 with 12% undecided. I think the things to point out are that Biden and Sanders are, by a good margin, better known than Harris or Warren in the state, and that the Trump margin or Trump vote ranges from 42-45, a kind of narrow 3-point range, whereas across the Democrats, we have about a 7-point range from 44-51. So I think that shows you that the Trump base is pretty solid in the low to mid 40s and doesn't vary much depending on who the Democratic candidate is. But the support for the Democratic candidate at this stage varies a bit more by 7 points or so across the four candidates we asked about.
Now, here in Wisconsin, Democratic voters will get a chance to vote in a primary from amongst these candidates. Obviously, a lot of the field will be winnowed down by the time they come to us. But what did you see when you compared and contrasted the various Democratic primary candidates?
So among the people who might vote in the Democratic primary, Biden leads with 28%, followed by Sanders at 20 and Warren at 17. That follows much national polling, though Sanders and Warren can be close in some national polls. But then when we get to the fourth place, Pete Buttigieg finishes fourth at 6%. And Kamala Harris, who's typically fourth in national polling, is only getting about 3% of the vote here. And so there's a little bit of a difference between us and national polling, primarily in Harris doing about 3 when she's doing somewhere in the low teens, 11 or 12 in most national polls.
Well, let's do our usual disclaimer. This thing is still early. It's a while before even Iowa gets to start casting votes. What do you do with numbers like this from this vantage point?
Absolutely. And I'm glad you brought it up. The way to think about all polls, and certainly mine at this point, is we are in the middle of the second inning. And the middle of the second score is not a sure guide to what the bottom of the ninth looks like. The purpose of watching these polls now is just like keeping score in a ball game, to see when candidates move up or when they fall off, when they get a temporary bump that then disappears, or launch on a strong trajectory. You're really watching a dynamic process that can and surely will change over time, but we have no idea where it will end up. What we have is this look at where we stand now, about the middle of the second inning.
Talking to Charles Franklin, director of the Marquette Law School poll. They've got new numbers out as of earlier this afternoon. Charles, not that long ago, you joined us to talk about Wisconsin popular opinion when it comes to issues of gun control. And you asked about a couple of those related issues in this survey. What kind of things did you see?
Yeah, first of all, not much change in opinion over the course after, you know, the various shootings that took place over the spring and summer. But what we continue to find is pretty strong support for background checks. 80% favor background checks. It was 81% last time, so hardly changed at all. We asked a new question about red flag laws. If a judge rules that someone is a danger to themselves or others, should the police be able to take their guns away? 81% supported that, just 12% opposed it. And in both of these questions, over three quarters of households with a gun support background checks and red flags. And it's over 80% that supported in non-gun households. But that's very strong support, even in the households with a gun. Support is much more divided on banning assault weapons. 57% support that. That's a little bit higher from 54% that we measured in the last year or so, but it's not a dramatic change. And here, the divisions between gun households and non-households are sharper, with gun households evenly divided 49-50 on an assault ban, whereas the non-gun households are much more supportive.
I want to tackle a couple more issues that I don't know if I've seen regularly in the surveys before, Charles. You asked about people's views of a diverse society and immigrants and about racial disparities. What stood out to you in what people had to say?
Well, I think the first thing to notice is we asked a question about whether an increasingly diverse society of racial and nationality groups makes the country a better or a worse place. And in this poll, 65% say a more diverse society makes America a better place. Just 4% said worse, 27% said no difference. We asked that same question in early October of 2016, and 53% said better, 9 worse, and 35 no difference. So we've seen a tick up of pretty significant margin from 53 to 65, saying that greater diversity is making America a better place. I think that shows up in national polling on this issue as well, that the country is somewhat more positive towards diversity and a very plural society than even it was 3 years ago in 2016.
And that's interesting, Charles, because in politics, it seems like this really hotly divided issue, critics of diversity, supporters of diversity, the surveys don't seem to paint that picture.
Well, we certainly see divisions when you break this down by partisanship and other demographic characteristics. So it's hardly the case that everyone's united in this view, and that's important to recognize that there are divisions over this. But it also fits with a kind of counter-cyclical public opinion that we've seen going all the way back to Reagan. When a conservative gets elected, public opinion tends to move in a more liberal direction. When a liberal is elected, it moves in a more conservative direction. That's happened for every president, at least since Reagan. And so I think we're seeing some elements of it here. President Trump's substantially negative policies towards immigration and immigrants is met with public opinion moving in the opposite direction.
Interesting. Charles, thank you so much for joining us today. We're all out of time. That's Charles Franklin with the Marquette University Law School poll, talking about their latest results out this afternoon. Coming up, training for a full marathon, big challenge. How about a 100-mile run? We'll meet a Wisconsin runner, a runner from Wisconsin anyway, who has the world record. Stay with us here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Verrett. Coming up, we'll talk to the Wisconsin native who now holds the world record for the fastest 100-mile run. Right now, it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Maureen McCollum remembering a fellow reporter.
Wisconsin Public Radio lost a dear colleague and friend over the weekend.
Fasten your seatbelt and turn up the radio. We're going on a road trip.
Glenn Moberg covered Central Wisconsin for WPR for 15 years. As a reporter and talk show host of WPR's Route 51, Glenn's love for his community was apparent on the airwaves and off. Rob Menser is WPR's current reporter based in Wausau. He knew Glenn for years, and he shares this essay on his legacy.
There's a moment I shared with Glenn Moberg that I keep thinking about. It was 2010, and we were standing around before a political debate that Glenn was moderating. I was a panelist.
Welcome to the U.S. Senate debate between incumbent Democrat Russ Feingold and Republican Ron Johnson. I'm Glenn Moberg of Wisconsin.
I'd been a newspaper reporter for about 3 years at that point, and getting to ask a question in the debate between Senator Russ Feingold and challenger Ron Johnson, it felt like a big deal. I mean, C-SPAN was there. It was Glenn who had made the debate happen. He was the one who pulled together a coalition of local media. He was the one who dealt with the campaigns. He could tell I was nervous, so he said to me, "Your question is going to be the bomb." And he added a curse word in the middle of the phrase, something I cannot say on the radio. It made me laugh, and it helped me shake off my jitters and feel good about what I was there to do. Here's the point of that story when I think about it now. It's that Glenn was generous enough and emotionally astute enough to reach out to me in just the right way. It was funny, it was supportive, it was enthusiastic about journalism, and that was Glenn. The news that Glenn had died was not a surprise. He had inoperable stomach cancer. He knew what that meant, and he was extraordinarily open about it, so it wasn't a surprise, but it was still a blow. Glenn had a daughter and a son. He was a part-time jeweler with his wife, Mary Beth. He played guitar. This is him playing right now. He fished. He swam in Wisconsin's lakes. He was 67 years old. I knew Glenn professionally. I can't claim to have known him the way his closest friends or longtime colleagues knew him. But, along with my colleague Shireen Seewert, I'm the one who works in Glenn's old office. When I applied for the job at WPR, it was to the position Glenn vacated when he retired, something he had to do earlier than he'd intended because he had cancer. I walk by his many radio awards in the hallway every morning, no pressure. Right now I'm sitting in what I still think of as his chair, speaking into his microphone. About a week after I started in this job in the spring, Glenn came in and spent a couple of hours with me talking about making radio. I was moved that he would take the time. He was very sick by then. But let me tell you, our conversation was super practical and useful to me as a new radio reporter. I started using some of his tips immediately. Glenn wrote a public post on Facebook in December about facing the end of his life. "Death," he wrote, "has a great way of focusing the mind. I'm trying to use the time I have left in the best way I can, making the world a slightly better place than it was the day before." One day a few months ago, I had used something he taught me in a radio story, and I thought, I should tell Glenn. So I sent him a message thanking him and letting him know his lessons had made a difference. He wrote me back, "You made me smile, Rob." As it turned out, he had about 3 months to live. I'm glad I told him. No one who knew him will be surprised that he showed that same grace and humor and love for journalism in the very last interaction we had. That's just who Glenn was.
That was WPR's Rob Menser reflecting on the career of Glenn Moberg, a WPR reporter and host who passed away this weekend. We're going to leave you with a message from Glenn. He shared it during his final appearance on WPR's Route 51.
If I could pass along one message to people, is treat every day that you're on this earth like it could be your last day. Be nice to people. If you love somebody, let them know that you love them.
Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and Wisconsin Public Television in partnership with the Wisconsin Humanities Council. Additional support comes from Lola Mary Peterson of Appleton. I'm Maureen McCollum.
I'm here in Wausau, Wisconsin, USA. I should be happy as a man can be. I can hunt and I can hike and I can fish and I can bike, and in the wintertime I can ski. But I'm staring at my shoes at the Bull Falls Brew, and I know why I'm feeling blue. WAUSA, and the only thing missing is you.
Now, for a lot of us who enjoy long-distance running, that's not really me, completing a marathon is a crowning achievement. That's 26.2 miles. Our next guest did that 4 times in a row. He's the new world record holder for a 100-mile run. He set the mark late last month at the Pettit National Ice Center in Milwaukee. The number to beat, 11 hours and 19 minutes, a leisurely pace of 6 minutes and 48 seconds per mile. Zach Bitter is an ultra-marathon runner and coach. He grew up near Manitowoc and graduated from UW-Stevens Point. These days, he lives in Arizona. Zach, thanks for joining us.
Yeah, thanks for having me on.
What drew you into this super long-distance running?
Yeah, that's kind of the million-dollar question. I think people tend to end up in ultra-marathons, I think, more so than deciding to go that way. But, you know, I got into running at an early age. I'm not sure if they still do these, but one of my middle school classes would do the Presidential Physical Fitness Challenge. And I learned at an early age I was much better at the mile than I was the 100-meter dash. And that kind of steered me towards track and cross country in high school and college. And in college, I learned a ton about the methodology of running and got really excited about that. And one of the other things I kind of learned was the long run is my favorite workout of the week. So when I got done with college, it was almost kind of a natural transition to start looking for races that were longer in distance.
Now, I know people who have trained for marathons, the 26-ish mile run, and that takes a lot of build up to get there. What is your training like to get ready for a 100-mile run?
Yeah, so I use a lot of the same principles that you would see in kind of marathon training or any endurance event where you're going to work on a variety of different systems of intensity. And the easiest way to kind of understand it is I try to keep the things most specific to race day intensity closer to the race itself and things least specific as farther away down the training plan as I can kind of get them. So some of those faster, shorter interval sessions that you maybe would see in like a marathon training plan or a 5K training plan, I'll still do those, but I'll do them earlier in the plan. And then as I get closer to the race itself, I'm starting to do a lot more things that are closer to the intensity of the race. So something like a long run that I do on Saturday and then follow that up with another long run on Sunday.
Now take us back to running on that track in Milwaukee. You already, as I understand it, have broken the U.S. record. You're in the hunt for a world record. Did you go into that run thinking this could be the one, this could be the world record?
Yeah, you know, I was pretty confident. I had a really good buildup in my training, and all the metrics that I've used historically to kind of gauge what a good target pace would be were where I felt they needed to be in order to make a good push at a pace in kind of the 640 minute per mile range. So I had a good feeling about it working out. And at the Pettit Center, if folks haven't been there, I mean, it's total climate control. They've got an indoor speed skating rink and hockey rinks there. So that was a huge variable I didn't have to be concerned about. Then it just kind of came down to making the logistics work on the day and minimizing any potential mistakes, bathroom breaks and things like that so that I could kind of stay moving for the most part.
You hear about runners hitting the wall in long distance runs. Is that a thing? Do you hit walls that you have to burst through maybe multiple times in 100 miles?
Yeah, I think, you know, there's probably a variety of different walls. I guess if you look at it from just a nutritional standpoint, I think you can sometimes hit a wall and it's like physiological breakdown. Whereas for me and 100 milers, it's rare that I get in a situation like that. It's more just like kind of pushing through self-doubt. So a lot of times what happens is you'll catch yourself kind of doubting what you're trying to do. And then it's just a matter of just kind of spinning that around to a positive and getting your paces back on where you're looking to target. And the more you can do that, or the more times you can do that, is the better the race ends up usually being. So I've had examples of falling short and running out of the ability to be able to push through that. And then you see, you know, big pace dips and things like that. Whereas on this one, for whatever reason, maybe just the 6-year journey I've been on to kind of get to this point gave me a lot of ammunition to kind of push past a lot of the hard spots and get into, you know, positive self-talk.
Talking to Zach Bitter, ultramarathon runner and coach and world record holder for the 100-mile run. And Zach, you were originally from Wisconsin, I think, and you got to break this world record here in Wisconsin. Was that a little extra special connection for you?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, being able to do it in the state that I first was introduced to running, where I grew up, competed in high school and college, and, you know, ran my first ultra marathon, it certainly made it extra special to kind of head this way and be able to do it in that state. So I couldn't be more grateful for that opportunity.
Now, I want to go back to that record-setting day. You hit the 100-mile mark. You had the record. A lot of people, I would assume anyway, that you'd be done then. You kept running.
Yeah, so the kind of nuance with the 100-mile world record as it stands is that it's close enough to another record. Folks that aren't interested or not looking or following ultramarathon probably don't realize, but we have these things called timed events, and some of the common ones are 6 hours, 12 hours, 24 hours, 48 hours, 72 hours, and 6 days, where essentially you're given this lot of time and you want to see how far you can get within that parameter. And the 12-hour one fits nicely into a kind of a dual target, because with the time I ran, 11 hours and 19 minutes, simply meant that if I could handle staying out there for another 40 minutes, I could potentially get a world record for that event as well. So part of it was kind of just knowing that, and just when I got to the point where I hit 100 miles, just saying, okay, now you can slow down, but stay out there, because 40 minutes is 40 minutes. Even with a pretty solid regression in pace, I was able to pick up an extra 4.88 miles and set that world record as well.
A lot of people aren't going to run 100 miles, but can you make the case that, hey, whatever your personal version of extreme is, give it a try, push yourself to maybe a limit you didn't know you had?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think even when you look in the context of some of these shorter endurance events, I think they can be more challenging and more difficult, because it's all relative. You know, it almost comes down to, like, pick your poison to a degree on race day. Do you want to suffer acutely for a short period of time, or do you want to suffer a dull pain for a long period of time? So regardless of whether you pick a 5K, 10K, half marathon, or decide to, you know, push up into the ultra distances, you can certainly realize your full potential with whichever one that is.
And Zach, what's your next goal?
So the irony of me getting this world record after kind of chasing it for 6 years is that originally wasn't my peak race for the second half of the year. I'm actually heading out to Greece in about 3.5 weeks to do a pretty historic race called the Spartathlon, which is a 153-mile race from Athens to Sparta. So right now I'm hyper-focused on recovery and trying to feel decent for that and see if I can get one more good race in this year.
All right. Well, good luck running from Athens to Sparta, and thanks so much for joining us, Zach.
Yeah, thanks for having me on. It's been a blast.
Zach Bitter is an ultra-marathon runner and coach. He's a native of Wisconsin. He talked with us about setting the world record for the fastest 100-mile run and the most distance covered during a 12-hour run, same run in Milwaukee. Coming up, fewer than two-thirds of children with disabilities earn a high school diploma. We'll find out how to help a child with disabilities have a successful school year. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up tomorrow at 7 on The Morning Show, Kate Archer-Kent and her guests look at issues of accessibility in the workplace and some of the challenges that remain for people with disabilities on the job. That's tomorrow morning at 7 here on the Ideas Network. Now, going back to school can be hard for any student, whether it's figuring out the social dynamics, taking on harder coursework, or deciding what future study and work they want to pursue. And young people with disabilities can face those challenges and sometimes additional obstacles. As a result, fewer than two-thirds of students living with a disability finish high school. But our next guest says there's good news. Parents, teachers, students, and other caring adults can work together to help students with disabilities up for success in school and beyond. Jennifer Laszlo Mizrahi is the president of Respect Ability, a nonprofit organization fighting stigmas and advancing opportunities for people with disabilities. She wrote a piece for HuffPost titled Tips for Parents of Children with Disabilities Who Want Them to Succeed in School. Jennifer, welcome back to Central Time.
Thank you so much for having me.
Well, before we get to your advice, Jennifer, let's get to some of the reasons that students with disabilities have a lower graduation rate from high school. What are some of the factors leading to that?
Well, one of the key factors is low expectations. A lot of times people think that someone with a disability, frankly, can't cut it. But the fact is that they frequently just need the right accommodations or some extra mentoring or some tutoring to really get through. But the high expectations are core critical. I myself am dyslexic. I didn't even start to learn how to read until I was 12 years old. By the way, I'm a super tall person. I was already 5'10", and I had really no literacy at that point. And so I didn't start learning how to read till I was 12. But a lot of people had really low expectations for me, and they thought, well, maybe I'm just not going to cut it. High expectations, I think, is the first and most important thing that we need to start with.
And that, you're hoping, comes from parents and people working at schools too, right?
Absolutely. But let's be quite honest about this, because there are some structural barriers to some individuals with disabilities. So, for example, Schools are paid by property taxes. And if you live in an affluent neighborhood, they're going to have more school counselors. They're going to have more tutoring and more ability for that child to get the scaffolding that they need to succeed. If you're in a low-income community that has no counselors or no special educators, it's going to be a lot harder. And so we see these, especially since school systems often are facing structural racism in how they're funded. The children of color with disabilities are frequently not diagnosed at an early age, or if they are diagnosed, they're not getting the early intervention that they need. And this is also true of immigrants, because sometimes people think, well, is that kid not reading because they have a learning disability or because nobody at home speaks English? What is the issue that's going on? Sometimes it's complicated to figure it out. So there's a lot of issues at play.
Before we get into your individual advice, do you see solutions for those kind of structural differences that are based on the school district boundaries you happen to live in?
Absolutely. I mean, to be perfectly honest, our family, I'm also a parent who knows what it means to raise a child with a disability. And we were in a school district that had no appropriate resources for our child. We literally moved. We literally moved to another district that could appropriately serve our child. Now, most people, they can't do that. So there's a lot of tools online that you can find. There's a tremendous number of resources for parents that are free, that are accessible on the internet, whether it's from the Autism Society, whether it is from, cerebral palsy groups or dyslexia groups. Understood.org has tremendous resources for parents of kids with disabilities, and all of them are free.
Talking to Jennifer Laszlo Mizrahi, president of the group Respectability. It's a new school year. We're talking about how students with disabilities can be set up for a successful school year. Let's get that article you wrote. It's posted at HuffPost. What would you say to parents at the outset of a new school year to try to make sure their child with a disability has the best possible school year?
Well, you have to have a really good relationship with your child's teacher. So from my perspective, that means, first of all, you get a list of your kid's class schedule. You find out who the teachers are, and you find out the email addresses for that teacher. And then you literally sit at your computer, your phone, and you write an email that says, here's some things you should know about my child. Here's some things that will help you really succeed more with my child and for my child to get the most out of this experience. And having that relationship that you have with the teachers, whether it's by email or you call them by phone, is very important. And so is taking the time to go and see them in person if you can. Every child with a disability has a legal right to something called an individualized education plan, or in some cases it's called a 504, depending on what the disability is. And that means you have a right to sit down with your teachers that are dealing with your child and talk about the individual needs and supports of your child. And so having that good relationship with the teachers is very, very important.
And I think you wrote, depending on the age of your child, maybe they can contribute, they can help write that letter.
Absolutely. Look, the fact is that parents can, in today's society, be what, is called helicopter parents. They can be hovering constantly on top of your child. And for parents of a child with a disability, that's particularly important because, frankly, our kids can really fall through the cracks. So let's say the government says, well, your child is legally allowed and required to get extra accommodations for test time. They should have extra time to take tests. Well, is that actually happening or is that not happening? Sometimes you have to be on top of it. But enabling your child to learn how to self-advocate is very, very important because you're not going to be there all the time. I mean, eventually you will die and your kid will be an adult and will have to live on their own. But the earlier that you can get your child used to advocating for themselves and having their own needs met, the better it's going to be, because essentially you want your child to be able to have a job and be as independent as possible. And that means they're going to have to stand up for themselves or roll for themselves if they use a wheelchair.
So that's the parent, part of what you said about the parent communicating with the school. How about what kind of things can parents talk about with their kid with disabilities as the school year kicks off?
I think one of the big things is to talk to your kid about their strengths, because when people see a child with a disability, they frequently will focus on their limitations or their challenges. But one of the key things is to find something that they really enjoy and that they are good at that they can monetize. You know, what are the things that they like that they will eventually be able to make a living at? So, for example, I'm dyslexic and it really impacts my ability to do math. I can't tell the difference between the number 18 and the number 81 sometimes. So I'm not going to make a living doing math. So what am I good at? I have to find something else. And what is that thing going to be? So the more that you can build up the skills of your child, and especially their self-esteem, because they might be facing bullying or they might be just hard on themselves because there's something that's really challenging to them, make them feel good about what they are good at.
We're talking to Jennifer Laszlo Mizrahi. She's president of Respect Ability, a nonprofit organization fighting stigma and advancing opportunity for people with disabilities. We're talking about kids with disabilities in schools, and you can join in at 800-642-1234. If you have a disability yourself, what are the most important ways that your parents and teachers supported you to be successful? What are the ways you wished they could have supported you to be successful? If you're a parent of a child with disabilities, what have you found to be effective in communicating with the staff at your school? If you're coming at this from the school side of things, what kind of advice do you have for parents and maybe your colleagues? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our conversation now with Jennifer Laszlo Mizrahi, president of Respect Ability, a nonprofit organization fighting stigma and advancing opportunity for people with disabilities. We're talking about a piece she wrote for HuffPost titled Tips for Parents of Children with Disabilities Who Want Them to Succeed in School. You can join in with your questions and maybe your experiences at 800-642-1234. If you have a disability yourself, if you're a parent of a child with disability, if you've worked in the schools with kids with disabilities, love to hear what you think really worked, what helped make sure there was a successful school year. Call 800-642-1234. We'll go to your calls now. Gwen is with us in Madison. Gwen, hi.
Hello. I have a son who has Asperger's syndrome, and he's in his 30s now. And he's working as a computer programmer at a credit union. When he was first diagnosed, he was doing terribly in school, and I knew he was smart, but he couldn't do the things that normal kids were doing as far as organizational abilities. So when we got a diagnosis, I had a meeting with the people who would be his teachers and the resource special education people. And I said to them, you know, I don't want you to dumb down the curriculum or tell him he doesn't have to do as much as the other children. I said, when he grows up and has to be self-supporting, an employer isn't going to say, oh, you have Asperger's syndrome, so you don't have to do the job the same way other people would. They would just fire him and find somebody who can do the job. And, of course, I always made sure that his homework was done so that when he had his resource time with the special education teachers, that he was able to use that time for help with things that he didn't understand that I couldn't help him with.
Gwen, thanks a lot for the call. Jennifer, what do you think of Gwen's approach there with the teachers and the resource staff?
Well, first of all, Gwen is a super mom, so she's got several things going for her. Number one, she had the high expectations that we talked about. She wanted her son with a disability to be in the workforce and to be treated like everyone else. So that's number one. That's fabulous. Number two, she was in touch with the teachers directly, personally. So that is incredibly important, and she was very successful at it. Number three is that she mentioned that her son had something called resource. Resource is a fabulous, fabulous thing for a child with a disability. What that usually means is that they're giving up a class time that might be for something else. So they might be missing art, they might be missing PE or some other elective, but what it means is that they get one class period or more to have somebody help them upskill in whatever area is their area of weakness. So for people with autism, frequently that is organizational skills. It might be social skills. And so that's what's going on in that classroom. But for that child to have resource, that means the child had an IEP, an individualized education program, or F504. And that's something that a parent has to ask the school system to do the testing and make sure their kid has the right and has the resources, because that's a really, really important thing, that every single day in the classroom, having somebody help that young person with their organizational skills or whatever else is very, very important to scaffold that person to success. And I must say that today in Wisconsin, there's better than the national average for people with disabilities in terms of employment, but only 41% of working age people with disabilities are employed. So, you know, look, only 41% have a job, and her son has a job. Why does her son have a job? Because she, as a parent, was really on it. She really took care of taking care of the important things, communicating with the teachers, high expectation, making sure the legal rights of her child were taken care of. And because of that, her child, who's now an adult, who probably really worked hard and deserves a tremendous credit for this on his own, is succeeding. So congratulations to Gwen.
Gwen, thanks for that call. Time for one more call. Amy is with us in Green Bay. Amy, hi.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I am a parent of a special needs awesome young man, and I'm also a teacher in special ed at the high school level. And a big challenge has been my husband. It's really opened my eyes. He was not familiar with the world of IEPs, and that made me really kind of look at differently how I do my job, but it also gave me some insight for how parents feel and how to approach things maybe a little bit more user-friendly with the verbiage and all of that. So thank you for this piece. I think it's absolutely awesome.
Amy, thanks a lot for the call. Amy has seen it from both sides here. Jennifer, we just have a couple minutes left. Can you give a message? I know your piece that we're talking about is targeted toward parents. Can you leave us with some thoughts for the teachers out there listening?
Well, I think the teachers who build a trusting relationship with the parents, and particularly the ones who let the parents know immediately when there's an issue in the classroom. One of the problems that teachers can really cause is if they let things build up, if a child is getting too frustrated, if the child is, you know, having too many failures in a row. So when the teacher lets the parent know right away, hey, today Johnny had an issue or Susie had an issue, and this is what the issue is, so the parents can talk about it with the child at home, because then you don't have that mental health issue build on top of the other disabilities that comes from the frustration. So that's my advice for the teachers, is let the parents know if something happened in the classroom that didn't go well, let the folks at home know so the folks at home can be helpful as well.
And in our last 30, 40 seconds or so, Jennifer, are we getting better in our schools at working with kids with disabilities?
We are getting better at working with kids with disabilities. The graduation rate is going up a bit, but we still have a very, very long way to go. And as evidenced by the fact that only 7% of students with a disability who are born with a disability actually complete college. So it's very, very important to have those high expectations and not just think about completing high school, but can we complete college? Or if they're interested in engineering or something that might have even more advanced education, why not go for it? Look, Stephen Hawking unlocked the secrets of the universe from a wheelchair. Why can't people with disabilities unlock the future and create a better world for all of us?
Jennifer, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you for having me. I really appreciate it.
That's Jennifer Laszlo Mizrahi, president of the group Respect Ability, a nonprofit that works on issues for people with disabilities. She joined us today to talk about a piece you can find at HuffPost. It's titled Tips for Parents of Children with Disabilities Who Want Them to Succeed in School. We have that linked, by the way, over at WPR.org/Central Time. And you can keep the conversation going on over on Twitter. If this is your story, if you're a person with disabilities yourself, a parent or a teacher, love to hear about your experiences. Tweet us at Central Time WPR. When technology manufacturing giant Foxconn announced it would build a plant in Wisconsin 2 years ago, officials promised it would remake the village of Mount Pleasant. But Corrine Hess reports that former property owners near the construction site say they were misled in pursuit of that vision, and now their homes are gone.
Every day in the state of Wisconsin, where properties are taken.
That's Alan Markovitz. He's an attorney for the Village of Mount Pleasant, arguing with residents in September 2018 over the number of properties being acquired for Foxconn. It was just one of many contentious board meetings since the Taiwanese manufacturer announced it would make LCD screens in the village. Kathy Jensen and her husband were at that September meeting. Their property and about a dozen others were acquired that night. Jensen says she started receiving letters from the village in fall of 2017, but ignored them.
Their initial paperwork said that they needed 0.13 acres of our frontage for a road project, but they would be generous and offer us basically twice the amount and buy our whole property, our whole 3 acres.
The Jensens later received a letter saying the village owned their property. They've since filed lawsuits in federal and county court. And that road project, it's done. None of the Jensen's property was affected, and there's no more road work planned for the area.
Mount Pleasant promised to purchase all of this land to convey to Foxconn, and Foxconn is not eminent domain.
Wisconsin municipalities can use eminent domain if there's fair compensation and the property will be used for a public purpose. But records obtained by Wisconsin Public Radio show in some cases, the village used road widening and other infrastructure plans to invoke eminent domain, even though those projects changed or were dropped before properties were sold. Sean and Sarah Mayer moved into their custom-built dream home on Wheaton Lane in May 2017. Rumors about a Foxconn announcement started about a month later.
I had just had 36 pallets of paving bricks delivered. We had put in 30-foot trees, and we never did the grass on the backyard. I never even leveled off the sand in the kids' sandbox.
That fall, the mayors received a certified letter saying properties on Wheaton Lane had been rezoned to industrial.
It was going to be purchased or taken from with eminent domain.
All of the homes on Wheaton Lane have been bulldozed. Emails obtained by WPR show village officials told the State Department of Transportation the road would be removed for Foxconn, but the road remains intact. Claude Lois, project director for the village, acknowledged the plan to remove it could change. As of late July, a Wisconsin Watch analysis found the village had paid $160 million for 132 properties to make way for Foxconn-related development. Village officials declined to be interviewed, but sent a statement saying the vast majority of the acquisitions were voluntary. Eminent domain attorney Daniel Bach says he's never seen this much land acquired for a single project.
I've spoken to a lot of people who are eminent domain experts on this, and I've not found one that has found a sort of a parallel circumstance anywhere.
Analyst Alberto Moel wrote a Foxconn investor guide. He says Mount Pleasant has purchased nearly 3,000 acres for a company that doesn't always keep its promises, pointing to factories in Indonesia and Harrisburg, Pennsylvania, that both fizzled.
You know, the company was just doing what it always did, and somebody took them at their word. They're like, we're just talking big game.
Here in Mount Pleasant, the company's plans for manufacturing at the site have taken a sharp turn. Rather than making massive flat screens, the plant will make smaller screens. And a recent report requested by the state suggests the $10 billion plant may be closer to $2 billion. Next year, County Highway KR will be expanded to accommodate Foxconn's future workforce. Racine County will have to purchase nearly 70 acres. That includes 14 farms and 5 homes. Corrine Hess, Wisconsin Public Radio.
Coming up tomorrow on Central Time, the Great Recession still has echoes in today's politics and society, with another possible recession waiting in the wings. We'll sort out the long-term changes we're still feeling today. There are calls for changes in American gun laws at the state and national level after the latest mass shootings. We'll look at the politics of gun laws in Congress, state legislatures, and the 2020 election campaign. And the Green Bay Packers kick off their regular season tomorrow night. We'll get a preview from a Wisconsin sports reporter. All that, plus a look at some of the top news of the day, is coming up tomorrow here on Central Time. Weekdays from 6 to 9 a.m., it's The Morning Show with Kate Archer Kent. Tomorrow at 6:30, now that kids are back in school, how early are they going to school? There's been pushback in recent years against early school start times, and some districts are starting to turn back the clock. Find out more tomorrow at 6:30 on The Morning Show. Coming up next, it's news from NPR and Wisconsin Public Radio. Then an activist shares stories from a life fighting for disability rights. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network.